So I appreciate that introduction, and I guess I want to say also thanks to the organizers for inviting me. For one, it shows a certain amount of bravery, wouldn't you say, to invite Ye Spooky Agency to come and stand in the middle next to one of your mics and all your electronic equipment. But it is nice also to be welcomed back as part of someone who came from this community. I still really believe that in many ways I'm part of you still, even though I'm working for the federal government. One of my proudest moments was as general chair of IEEE Security and Privacy 1 year, and also one of the hardest years I ever worked in my life. So the organizers for this event really deserve a lot of kudos, especially for selling out and having so many people come. So what I did today is I know there's really a couple of things that you want to ask me about. So the talk is about perspectives on security and cyberspace, and I have allowed about an hour for myself, way too many slides, as my folks will say. Anybody who knows me knows I put way too many slides in, so I'll probably cut myself off or ask someone to give me a high side about 60 minutes in, because I think within 90 minutes that there's 30 minutes of a combination of things you might want to have a conversation about. Does that make sense? So one of the things I did with this talk is I tried to touch a lot of bases. You know, since so much of what we do at the agency is classified, but yet a lot of it is unclassified, and some of it's very esoteric, and some of it's very clear. I tried to put in a combination of those ideas, so you should connect with some things, and I'll apologize in advance to those who will find some of this a bit of a repeat of things you already know. If we had, I don't know that I can take questions during, but we'll just see how that goes. We'll just see how that goes. So I've had an introduction, so you know who I am, that time on the outside. I've been at the agency now 4 years. I've had 3 jobs at the agency in 4 years. So. You know, in academia, we're used to moving what? You might get 2 promotions in your entire life. And so most of the people that I started with are in the same place that they began. I joined the agency a little over 4 years ago as the deputy director for research. I was hired out of PNNL, largely because they wanted someone with an academic, scientific background who had an open mind and also a clearance who could come in and work with the agency. My clearance was through DOE, not DOD. And so a lot of what I learned when I came behind the veil was very new. So that gave me a unique perspective, and it served me well. One of the things the agency likes to do, as it's developing leaders at all levels, is it likes us to have some diversity. So you would think I was diverse enough coming in from the outside with that background that you just heard about, but I think quite wisely they asked me to spend a year doing a different task, and they made me head of education and training globally for NSA. That was kind of startling because I had less than a month to prepare for that particular role, including the closing out of the deputy director job and preparing to when I would wrap up. And we were responsible for delivering something like 5 million hours, not semester hours, thank goodness, but 5 million hours of classroom training of various kinds over the course of that year in all different disciplines, everything from things I had not worked with, different kinds of languages, to, of course, cyber, and so on. So, and then when the previous director who hired me and retired in September, I became the director. So I've been in place almost a year now. And really glad to be back here at about this time, as it feels a little bit like full circle. One of the first major talks I gave when I started as director was to go overseas to Doha and to Qatar to give a talk there to their annual conference and discuss a number of things, including unclassified cyber. And we did talk a little bit about privacy and a little bit about diversity. So, so I wanted to start with what I think of as a very short primer on some of the key things that are important to understand about our agency, NSA, CSS. Oh, by the way, does anybody know that the CSS? Were you wondering about what that is? So CSS, Central Security Service, that you can think of NSA as designating the civilian part of the house, and CSS is designating the military. So we're roughly half and half civilian and military organizations. Since we do a lot of external work with the forces, that's very appropriate. And it makes for quite a milieu. I don't know how many of you have worked in split organizations, but when you, especially you think about a research organization, a place that's half military, I guess Cynthia would have a good feel for that in terms of what it, what it's like at the Naval Academy, as well as Naval Postgraduate School there. So the 3 different areas that I wanted to emphasize that are important to our agency that we serve in research are the IAD mission, the Information Assurance mission, the Signals Intelligence mission, and what we think of as our DEFEND mission, which is, I've amplified this here with our Threat Operations, our NSA Threat Operations Center. The reason this is perhaps important is I'm betting that most of you, until the newspaper articles hit had largely dealt with the Information Assurance Directorate, if you dealt with us at all. I won't ask you to raise your hands, but realizing that might be sensitive, but that's probably where you came from. So you were probably looking at more of the work that was done on the outside in terms of standards, formal verification. You might have been involved in some of the early work in intrusion detection, which was largely funded out of NSA. You might not be aware of that. And not so much the other mission. A critical thing of what we do, which you all know from having read the newspapers, is the signals intelligence mission. And I've got a slide in a moment that I'll dive in a bit more deeply as to what that is, where we look at what, basically, how do we understand what's going on foreign to support questions that our policymakers might have in several other missions. We also act in an advisory capacity and in support of other government agencies, and that's where you'll see things such as the warrant-based activities that we support, and you'll also see advice that we've given in issues such as the Sony case that came through where we were tapped for our expertise in cyber specifically. The third one is about 10 years old now. It still seems a little bit new on the inside of the agency because, frankly, most of the people I work there with at my level have been in place for about 30 years, which makes me a little bit of an duck from that standpoint. But this is intended to bring together the information that might be learned from the information assurance side, things that might be gathered from signals intelligence, wrap it all up around the cyber problem, and have some way to help support defense more broadly. And so we think of that as the defend mission. I haven't listed here another piece that you've heard next to our agency quite often, and that's U.S. Cyber Command. And that's because while U.S. Cyber Command is not part of ourselves, it's not part of NSA, we're joined at the hip, or I should say at the head, because our director is dual-hatted as head of NSA CSS and as Cyber Command. So the man has three different jobs and all of them quite busy. So those are our three primary mission areas, plus one if you like. I want to note that since this is starting out at least as a research talk and how we run research and what the research directorate is like and some of the projects we have, I want to emphasize the note at the top. My job as the director of research is to make sure that this nation, the United States, retains a scientific advantage over adversaries through mission-oriented research. So basically, my job is to make sure that we maintain or get ahead of the threat using technology based on scientific underpinnings. Well, why science? Because if you can make a basic science advancement ahead of, or at least in, ideally, ahead of either publicly or privately, of your adversary and leverage that, then that knowledge gives you a much greater jump than if you're looking at a merely incremental improvement. So investments in science are key. Now, our investments are very long-term and very short, and I'll talk about that in a minute. This I want to put forward because, again, much in the news is about how the nation right now, and again, I know there's an international audience, but I also know you've been reading our paper, so my apologies if it seems a little bit U.S.-centric, but I do work for the federal government after all. But I think it's important for me to put forward this slide because it talks about why, what we do and why. We are an organization that's authorized and is required and needed and is an integral part of success in a lot of different dimensions. So everything from military support operations to thwarting of terrorists, protecting nuclear weapons, hostage rescue, and that can be both citizens who might be taken up abroad or our military folk, could be a short-term or long-term. Technology transfer, I alluded earlier to the work that we did, prior to me, from NSA Research back in the 90s when I was a student and working the intrusion detection mission in terms of investing in the outside world, saying this is a great technology, here's the thing that needs to be advanced. That's part of our mission too. Foreign signals exploitation, this is probably the thing that makes people the most uncomfortable. Most nations find that they need a way to uncover and understand what others are doing. And so from our standpoint, non-US is foreign signal exploitation. That is our job as assigned by the US government through the president. So we're executive branch and that's what we do. And then early interest detection, another area where we invest in heavily, is identifying interest. There is a really strange way, to me, of saying, are there emergent problems in the world? And that can be anything from militaristic problems to support in other areas, such as disease. So there's so we often will think, and this is understandable given the news, and I think actually understandable given the volume of breakdown, that the only thing NSA is interested in or is supporting would be the military operations, but that's not actually true. There are other types of problems in the world. It's just that the ones we mostly hear about nowadays have to do with guns bombs and that type of thing, but there are also issues of disease and how one can support those types of activities in terms of reducing spread. So these are some of the things that we're involved in. Okay, I'm not going to bore you with lots of quotes, but because I can't give you stats, I'm just going to point you to the canonical. Here's somebody out who believes that what we do is important. We could talk about how much the investment in the intelligence community helps or hurts, but I don't think that would further us on the research side. But I do want to point out that our mission is highly valued. I hear this, I won't say every day because research, I'm not connected with operations every day, but we literally do save lives in the military. We do provide necessary information that helps save lives when policymakers make better decisions. And I work with people that are among the smartest, most ethical, and patriotic in the country. And they care deeply about the Constitution, as do I. So, getting off soapbox, Deb, back to research talk. I'm not sure that many of you, how many of you, maybe, I don't, is this a boring slide? Do you know what signals intelligence is? Okay. So, basically, any kind of a signal, and it's just written down as electrical impulses, but that would include documents and videos and other things and sounds in the air. So there's the get it, know it, use it aspect, and those are the things that we, the agency, from the signals intelligence standpoint, are optimized very well to do. So we are exceptional at collecting signals, very proud of that. We are also very good at the know it side. I would have said exceptional even a couple of years ago. I still think we're exceptional. I don't mean we've gotten worse. I just mean lots of people have gotten very good at data analytics. And so this is an area where there's lots of people that are great at putting the bits together, drawing the dots, and understanding what the word is, and then the use it. Now the use it is a little less in our wheelhouse because primarily what we're doing is supplying information to others who will act. So that brings me to the other piece of this diagram that I think is more important to emphasize in terms of understanding our agency's mission and purpose. I noticed, I put down on the bottom, customer target. The agency does not just make up, gee, we think it would be great to take a look at country X today because that sounds cool or we think it might be a problem. We actually are given targets or given information that is needed or given decisions that need input. And those are the things that drive where we would look and how we would use the signals and how we would then perform the analysis. And then that information would be provided into the customer environment. One reason I wanted to write this down is it's a little bit different in cyber because I showed you the IA mission. I also showed you the NTOC mission. And clearly in cyber time, if you're going to write something down and pass it on to another policymaker, it's gone. That information that you gathered is just, it's just got a shelf life like this. And so there is an action that takes place, particularly when it comes to defense, that is very carefully triaged in terms of who has the authority to take that particular action. So in some cases, Cyber Command is the only place that has the authority to make a change for something we've observed, and we need to make a quick handoff to Cyber Command. That's one of the arguments for the dual hatting between our director in terms of running NSA and Cyber Command so he can make that judgment quickly. In other cases, we can inform our defensive mission and they can make adjustments as well. So that's also important. So that very high level for those who hadn't seen signals intelligence mission before. Now you might not have seen this picture. This is relatively new. I thought it might be interesting to you because this is a research cloud. Anybody seen this picture before? So this is a bit different, and I wanted to put this up because it shows a contrast between where we were in analytics and where we're progressing in analytics, because this is the environment that I'm expecting most of the, and we all are expecting most of the analysis to be done in the future. And I got this by courtesy of the Signals Intelligence Directorate. So this is used with permission, not FOUO. You're welcome to cite it or use it how you like. Nothing classified. Everyone's very careful. So what we used to do would be, you would think more of gather the information, read it, disseminate it, come up with it, read it, understand it, perhaps delve into additional details and then disseminate it. So more of a crunching through. You might think of this as a read and report. That's really way oversimplifying because there's a lot that it takes in order to produce that intelligence. But that would be the cycle. So information question, information cycle. Discovery has more to do with there's a question and you don't know what the answer is. So these would be the broader, bigger picture. So I would think of most of what we do when we talk about scientific inquiry to follow more in the discovery.
discovery is harder because when you're trying to figure out something and you don't know where the sources are, you have to have a very different approach than if I'm given a bunch of files and I'm supposed to make sense of those. So when you hear us talk about the discovery mission versus the foreign intelligence production mission, that's the division. And that's some of what you see in terms of the conversations around law related to this agency, because the discovery mission, although it's not brand new, it's over 10 years old, and I think more like 15 or so, and I'm sure they were using techniques along those lines earlier. The laws, a lot of them that established us back when you go back 60 years, were along the lines of the foreign intelligence production, which had to do more with file, come up with the result. So that's something that's changing. The other thing that I think is really important in terms of the dialogue, and here's another place where all of you can be of great help and a thing that's important to us, is the collaborative space. So you know, after 9/11, there was much conversation about failure to connect the dots that existed and were not put together, and a lot of fairness to that assessment. So a thing that the intelligence community writ large, meaning all of those different organizations that have intelligence authorities, and ourselves, CIA, NRO, NGA, FBI, DHS, Coast Guard, and just a long list of players, we need to have a way to better collaborate. So there's one way you can collaborate, that's I find information, you've got a need to know, I give it to you. That's not exactly going to work in cyber time. And it doesn't work with the speed of much of the threat environment that we're dealing with internationally now anyway. I mean, the speed of Twitter is much faster than that, and it would be not sensible for the intelligence community to work less than the speed of Twitter. So in order to get around that, the notion is let's go to an intelligence community collaboration space. That's what this is intended to communicate, so that there will be easier ways to share. Now that in and of itself, just stopping here creates almost a lifetime of research problems, because I mentioned authorities. We don't, and please just set aside the newspaper, we don't have that authority to do certain things with data on U.S. citizens. And it's not gathered with a warrant, and I don't have the right to have it. I mean, I as the agency, and also I as the person who leads researchers who do use live data. That's not true of other places. So DHS has got a domestic mission. So if they, and FBI has got a domestic mission. So obviously the FBI, while it's investigating domestically, has got information. So how do we make sure that NSA does not access and use the information it shouldn't have, while still sharing what it ought to have, to others? And how do we make sure that we protect sources and methods, while still handling the sharing? And how do we make sure if there's a change, if we find out that a certain piece of data shouldn't be shared one direction or another, or should be shared that we didn't realize, how do we make that change quickly? So there's a whole lot of work that needs to be done in terms of appropriate, recorded collaboration and sharing, and it needs to be fast enough eventually to operate at cyber time. You notice this diagram that I have from our operations folks, looking at discovery and foreign intelligence. It's not talking about cyber, but clearly this is the kind of thing that needs to happen. So whoever's in charge of that information, they're going to have that problem, whether it's us or others. So I'm not saying I own that whole space. I'm just saying that's a place that's important. All right. I knew I'd do this. 18 minutes in. Finally, she says cybersecurity again. All right, so now what I wanted to do is talk a little bit about NSA and its role in cybersecurity, and I'm going to give you a bit about research after this, and then talk a bit about some of our programs, and also make a fun announcement of a competition that just recently concluded. So we will talk about most of these pieces. I actually won't say much about this one or this one, because these are no longer mine, but the Center of Academic Excellence intern programs was something I had the pleasure of running while I was over in ADET, running education and training. So we bring in people from your Center of Academic Excellence, research schools, and other kinds of organizations, other kinds of CAE organizations, I mean, and bring them in with clearances. So I've briefed them fully TSSCI on all the innards, and they've gotten top-level briefings on all of these different pieces in the summer cyber camp. So that's been really successful. An unclassified program there, the Cyber Summer program, Gen Cyber, is a way to reach out to people who are teaching kids and help them understand better how to teach cybersecurity programs. So they get grants, they work with some of our people, they also train one another, so that's another good program. It's modeled on one we do in language called Star Talk. So we'll talk about some of these other things, though. I like to include this picture when I speak with researchers, because again, it helps me foot stomp
the difference between the sort of research that I lead through my groups in cybersecurity and the kinds of research that I used to do on the outside when I was an academic and when I was working at PNL. And that, you know, clearance aside, it's a difference in perspective. It's a difference in perspective. What we do has to work. Every dollar that I invest in any research program has got to ultimately have its eye on, we're going to affect the mission positively in some way, whether it's by making sure the next generation has great education and making sure that there's a broader awareness of our techniques and trade track, which is one of the motivations behind the CAE summer camp. Those kids aren't all coming, pardon me, those college student adults are not all coming. I'm so sorry. Gray hair, sorry. they're not all going to come to work for us, but it's very valuable for this country to have people that understand what it is that we do to talk about it. That's why it's important for me to come and speak to an international audience as well, so you can get some insights into how we operate. And I think that takes some of the mystery out of it, and then when we disagree, we can at least do it on a basis of understanding what we don't like and do well. So this is a picture of our Threat Operations Center, and this is getting at the reality of one aspect of cyber, 24/7 assault. 24/7 activities. That means human beings, large groups of them, this is not a small unit, need to coordinate handoff across a normal lifetime, normal activities, the work that they do. They need to work long-term threats that might span a couple of days, two or three, or maybe even longer if it's a re-emergent. They also need to be able to work on the short term. They need to be able to work all night long and all day long. I've spent time with them on Thanksgiving, 2 years out of the last three, and they have their turkey and they're also sitting at their terminals trying to make sure that the threats that they see coming through are properly triaged. They also need to be able to interact across the appropriate parts of government and the rest of the country that's necessary, and they might need, you see there's a command center just barely sleeping in the back, need to gain insight from the commander of the U.S. Cyber Command, aka our director, from either of his hats in order to take a step. We also have a lot of information, so some of it has to do with locality, what's going on in the world as a context for the cyber action, what might be more specific for particular activities that happen, and frankly, when I walk through, sometimes they use that as a television because you've got to stay awake, folks, when you're working that hard. So there is some need to keep people awake and alert. But by looking at this, we begin to think of cyber a little differently, and that's what I mean by a perspective change. All of these aspects need to gel, need to work together, need to be coordinated. Not all perfect, they all need to coordinate in order for the mission to be accomplished, which is to identify, block, appropriately handle any threats that come from the cyber. You can imagine some similar activities when you're looking at the overall other kinds of operations as well, but now just cyber. So lots of different people come through here. There'll be operators, there'll be senior leaders, there'll be military who might need to take action. There might be people who need to come through and think through what is the damage being done to my federal agency, the question, or there might be someone who needs to come through and talk about the international scene. I've had to interact with them relative to potential threats to some of the sites that I invest in, some research facilities that might or might not have had a compromise. So this is a place that's very busy, very active, and very professional. It means that a different kind of research is needed, not just research that helps figure out what they're doing for the day, but also thinking through, and this is one of the things that's hardest with an operational unit, how they might transform. Because what we thought of 10 years ago, I'm not sure any of us think that cyber defense is going to look the same 10 years hence as it did 10 years ago. So we expect that this kind of thing would transform. So our goal in research is to think through what these people need in the next 5 years. And of course, we've been thinking about it for a while, so we're also fielding things that we came up with from the past. My research time horizon here tends to be right around a 2-year to 3-year. In some areas, as I'll mention later, it's much longer. But this is important to have in mind. And I mention it for many reasons, but partly because often in academia, we get focused right on our specific area and wanting to optimize that and find funding to invest in that one piece. And we understand how valuable that one piece is. But from my perspective, I need to raise specific ones of these if they're at the low end, if they're a weakest link. But I also might want to raise something if it's going to help us get ahead. But the whole place needs to work well, and it's every bit as much dependent on the professionalism of the people in the room as it is the technology. So if they can't work as a unit well across all of government, then this place isn't going to work either. So there's a whole human side of activity which doesn't tend to fall in my wheelhouse. We're largely
99%, I would say, STEM, but there's a very human element here that needs to be dealt with that people look at. Okay. So, because I think it also is useful to look at our individual parts, I thought you might be curious, and this might again be fruitful for questions at the end, so I'll leave it up for a moment in case you want to ask about some pieces. I don't have insight into every single one, but I'll be happy to get back to you through the conference with those that I don't know. But we specifically, and this is a mission slide, this isn't one of mine, we specifically call out all of these different areas as being critical to work together to make that center I just showed you effective. And it includes all kinds of different participants, everything from the net warfare planners you see on the upper right to the cryptanalysts that I think we're best known for on the lower left. And by the way, that attack targets there, I had to laugh a little bit. That's not how to attack targets. This is defenses unit, this particular one. This is actually what target, what is it about that target that's being attacked, that's being discovered. Cyber Command is the defensive arm of the military that would come into play with that, where intelligence. Okay, so linguists. So obviously we all know that none of us in this room speak just one language. And so when we're dealing in cyber as well, even if you're down to bits and bytes, comments and so on, it is important that as part of this huge enterprise that we understand multiple languages as well as the cultures associated, because that can have an effect. It's not just the techniques and tradecrafts that change between nations and the kinds of interaction or the engagement that's being worked. It's also just something as simple as, can you read the comments to understand what's in that malware a little bit better if you're trying to do an analysis? And there's something like 100 different languages that we consider important in the agency. And so you need to step back and think about that as well. Any of those 100 could be places where people who are smart at working cyber coders are. And 100 isn't anything but a drop in the bucket when we think about the languages in the world, 7,000-ish by most counts. And most of the people that are working in, say, counter-terrorism organization tend to speak two or three, and we'll mix those in the conversation. So you're really looking at 7,000. Choose about two or three if you want to think through all the possible permutations. Hence, we like automation. Another comment I wanted to make in terms of perspectives, and this again I think is useful for the community to get involved in and to think through, especially as you hear the language from our longer term leaders, the ones who've been in place in this business a long time, and the newer leaders. I use this slide from a lot of perspectives, but I'm using it here today just to indicate, when you think about what's on the left, this looks very military. I mean, it feels like the way a military unit would break things down. This is probably how we cybersecurity researchers, cybersecurity professionals now think through. This is not an NSA slide now, this is a DEB slide. Thoroughly vetted with NSA, so this is Research Director Deb, but it's Deb and it's not a picture of our mission. So thinking through who the cyber adversaries are, we might get something like that as a description of what NSA should care most about. Thinking through who in the nation, who in the globe needs to be protected and what kind of activities would look a lot more like the thing on the right. So the contrast between the older style thought process of how do we protect the individual component parts, how do we make sure that either protect or obtain, depending on whether I'm thinking of the IA mission or the signals intelligence mission, protect or obtain data, voice, radio, TV, satellite, that's a really different way of looking at the world and thinking through, well, how do we make sure that hospitals stay up and running? How do we make sure that the critical infrastructure is not negatively impacted in a militaristic conflict? How do we make sure that those people that need to shop, do commerce, i.e., can be effective banking and travel and so on? So really nowadays the verbiage on the cyber side tends to be to the right, but the old style is here. And so you'll see again a mismatch sometimes when you read the papers, when you hear somebody is more used to this terminology, thinking of protecting the things, and not so much about the engagement, the activity, the person, the civil liberty, the way of life that we're attempting to protect on that side. And that's a necessary change I think we're beginning to see as people become more accustomed to thinking of cyber as something that doesn't belong just to in the military as a thing to protect or just in the NSA as a thing to protect, but a whole of globe activity. And so here is where I think some of the tensions will come as we move forward in terms of what authorities and what activities should my agency and others be involved in, and how we've where we've started. So thinking that's where it's coming. other thing I wanted to show you on this slide is, again, now, we all know that most of what happens in terms of vulnerabilities tends to be the low-hanging fruit, right? So people still have the default password or no password in areas where they shouldn't, and they still click practically every button they might. That, by and large, that's not our main concern, although we do run across that from time to time if the target being compromised was vulnerable there. But we're mostly interested in things like the nation-state actors, the malicious hacking groups, not the benign ones. Malicious insiders, as you well know, we need to worry about that. Rogue individuals who might cause damage, which to me are one of the most worrisome, I can't call them groups, one of the most worrisome categories, because it's much easier to understand a group and project than an individual who might decide to go rogue. And then other types of activities as well that are emerging that are a little different. So the thing on the left is capturing more or less where NSA fits, and the thing on the right is more of what the globe needs to protect. And deciding how to do that mapping really isn't going to look so much like this as we move forward. Okay. Wanted to include this slide as well, again, especially if I use these as a leave behind. I think it's kind of nice for you to see some of the internals. I got this one from Cyber Command. I thought you might like to see their view of the world as of the end of 2014. From my standpoint, again, the key I want to note is that destruction is becoming a much greater concern. It used to be when I would put forward these slides or use them myself, the thing we would worry most would be about exploitation, obtaining of information, or leakage of secrets. You see a lot of that in the paper. I'm not that happy about having my federal database information leaked either. Disruption of service, commerce, we worry about that quite a lot, but destruction. And by that, I don't mean damage. I mean irreparable destruction is where we see that term heading, is a major problem. So thinking through how one can replicate and protect and defend against those kinds of devastating consequences really needs to become a greater part of our cyber lexicon as we try to balance where we place our resources. What you're seeing here are not so much destruction as they are damage. And I distinguish between those in terms of the consequence and the ability to recover, to reconstitute. If you can quickly reconstitute, in my book, in the Dev language, it's not really destruction in my world. You'll see here, again, that's what U.S. Cyber Command is concerned about. I thought on the bottom, just I'm not going to go into these because policy is not my area, but we are seeing a lot of strategic guidance. I think this is important. It's part of the maturing of the field. This is where you, as techies, need to step up and weigh in, please. Because it's really important that the people that inform these decisions are people that understand the technology, and that's across the globe. Because this is where we codify what it is that's going to be our culture, essentially. So I'm an employee of the federal government, and I have an opinion which I express internally, as does not surprise any of you. But I do have a day job that requires me not to weigh in public in certain areas. What I can do is urge you to think through what kind of a cyber culture you want in this nation and be sure that you raise your voice, not yell. That includes talking to me, which is fine. It's one of the reasons I step out is that it helps me when I'm outside and I hear people's concerns and I take them back in. All right. So again, I'm talking at like, is this helpful? I could speed through a little of this and do more projects, but sometimes it's nice just to get a sense of context. So research directorate, as with many things, it's much harder for me to talk about what I do now because just about every aspect of it is classified in some way, including my budget and the number of people. I am allowed to say I have north of 500 people and south of 1,000 who work for me. We have a lot of contractors who work for us as well, who we supervise, and others who are detailed into us. And then there are places we give grants and contracts to. So very large, vibrant workforce. People are often quite surprised by how diverse research directorate is. Many people, and I actually thought at first it was mainly going to be cyber, maybe information assurance. That's an important part of the mission, but it's only two of my groups. So I have one group on the left, Laboratory for Physical Sciences, which is a neat construct. It's got multiple locations. The one you see pictured is largely unclassified, and we have many contractors working there. They've had background checks, but not clearances. They're working in unclassified spaces, some of them from named hostile nations, and that's because there are brilliant minds in every country, and if they are willing to work with us and they fit in with our programs, we hire the best of those people. And so Laboratory for Physical Sciences has a clean room, we have Faraday cages, we do all the optics, all the kinds of things that you would expect in a typical physical sciences facility if you walked it into a university or a production place of that type. We also do the more tightly held work as well, but we do a lot of work on the outside. And that's one of the places many of my postdocs end up, by the way. A lot of people go there. The extreme right, lower right, the Laboratory for Analytic Science is a very new stand-up. That's something we worked, the director that hired me started advancing that project when I began as deputy, so I had a bit of a bird's eye of the stand-up for that. That's in North Carolina. That's actually a SCIF space, a classified facility that's located on a campus inside the campus perimeter. So just a stone's throw from there, you can walk to the library. So this is embedded in the campus. We've also got, as I required, unclassified space because you can't come in and just sit in the SCIF all day, for goodness sakes, and expect you're going to interact with the professor. That's just silly. So now we have both classified and unclassified space in North Carolina. It's intended to get at joint working of problems. The classified space lets us bring in mission people as well as researchers from my site to work the actual data, and it's protected just as any SCIF would be. The unclassified side lets us take some of those problem spaces out, and for those uncleared faculty and students who work with us, they can work those particular problems with us jointly, and some have clearances and work with us inside. We also bring in industry players as well. So this is intended to be a different way to collaborate across research, NSA research, academia, and also got some other government organizations that work with us, too, in industry. The notion being if you can get more people together, more eyes on the problem, thinking further out, we can, again, take advantage of all of that knowledge, all of that outside passion, and the outside's understanding of the kind of culture we want to develop to come up with new breakthrough technologies that should benefit our future analysts as we step forward. This is intended to help us break loose of a same old kind of a mindset. So that's a great facility. It's very new. So we'll see how that works out, but that's the goal. We also have a place where we do some work in advanced language, although that's now integrated in my computer science group now. I consolidated it, and then you see the main site in the middle. That's where my main office is, where I spend much of my time, the time I'm not spending defending budgets, is over at Emerson out in Laurel. And I'm going to say a little bit about what we do there. But our mathematicians are there. Our trusted science group is there. R3, our physical sciences, is off-site. Laboratory for telecommunications, I bypassed too. That's another facility that's located near University of Maryland, but it's off-site, so it's its own facility. It also has an upstairs that's entirely unclassified. That's where our Internet of Things work is done, for instance. Now, since I've been rattling on a lot, I'm going to pick and choose a little as to which of these topics I speak to. And again, since the slides are leave behind, this does give you a sense of what we're doing. I think, in fact, I'll dive forward right here. I mentioned the facility in Emerson. Now, I know wireless security isn't jazzy on the outside anymore, but for us, this is a very big deal. Research was the first place in the intelligence community to be able to have both classified and unclassified wireless inside the fence. So meaning in my office, my TSSCI office, I can have an unclassified laptop working on unclassified material connecting to the internet, and I can also have my classified workstation there all very safely. And by the way, my Fitbit's allowed in too. That's another innovation which I love. I actually have to tell you, use this more than the laptop nowadays. I hate dragging along the laptop. I would take my tablet, but we do not have this set up for tablets yet. Coming. But we were able to work through the technological challenges, the algorithmic challenges, and the much harder than any of those policy challenges in order to get the wireless set up. This is a slight show of some of the underlying techniques that were used. I think the main innovation here was that, A, we decided that the Emerson facility, when we built it, should be a living laboratory, and that we would design in as many new techniques as we could. And so that gave us an opportunity, instead of using traditional antenna systems, to put in a distributed antenna system where we dropped the power significantly, which made it harder for signals to be picked up outside the building, which made it more possible to protect the building itself. And that was one of the key pieces in enabling us to manage this technology. It's also partly why we're allowed to have an internet cafe inside. Again, I know that's not very jazzy for those of you working on the outside. You've had those forever. You've got them in your house. But it's a big deal in the IC to be able to bring your cell phone in and not leave it baking in your car, and to be able to use it during lunch at the internet cafe. So a lot of things that we do in research are intended to bridge that gap between what had to be locked down for the security of the work that we do, because make no mistake, we are under constant threat and attack. There's a lot of people that would like to gain access to our TSSCI networks and still allow our people a certain amount of those technologies that we take for granted on the outside, and that's really important. And that was out of our Trusted Systems Group with a lot of collaboration with the Information Assurance Directorate and the Technology Directorate. I put this up as well. This is actually relatively old technology now at the agency, and I'm mentioning it primarily because we're using this, we're continuing this line. It's an example of a place we've been investing for a lot of years, host integrity. So it's a little bit, go back to your tripwire days, taking a look at change. It's gotten much more sophisticated than that, and this is a technology that we field. So a lot of what protects the agency, I can't talk about. This is one of the pieces, the older pieces that I can. We've integrated it with cloud, of course, that was a natural, and some of you might have noticed that we did a lot of our cloud work early on open source, so our Cumulo work was released open source quite a while back. And we talked about this. I put this note in to indicate that the sharing is key, and I can't foot stomp this enough. We really need a lot of eyes on this problem. I don't think that NSA should be the leader, by the way, in identifying how to handle secure and private sharing, and it's not because I don't think it's a place we should invest in, it's because really ask yourselves this: would you rather have a solution that you've developed yourself and that we adopt because we think it's great, or would you like to have us develop a solution we think it's great and then hand it to you? Realist here. So I'm happy to help nudge this along, but I'm really hoping for a lot of leadership, a lot of development here. I would love to be a fast follower in as much technology as we can deal with in that space that helps us get along. So here's where I saved. I did save a little bit of an announcement I wanted to make, but I wanted to mention something that's important to us as well, which is advancing the science of cybersecurity. I know we still argue about whether cybersecurity is a science. I think that to me, and I've gone back and forth on that too, but what I am convinced of is that there are certain aspects of cybersecurity, of security, that can and should be approached as a scientist and scientifically. And so I'm happy with that, and I'm investing in those pieces, and that's all great. We have a best scientific cybersecurity paper competition, and one of the things I'm going to do, since I didn't talk forever on that last slide, is go ahead and announce the winners of this year's competition. I was able to sign off on that, so I thought this would be an appropriate place at USENIX Security to go ahead and let you know who those papers are. So I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. The next wave is our internal publication to research that we put out. It's not a scientific publication, but it has some depth to it, some meat. We are often looking for external authors and ideas, and it's a place where we'll put together different topical areas, not just cybersecurity, but we did this one on a blueprint for science and cybersecurity a while back, and it's pretty good. You might notice this top journal of sensitive cyber research and engineering. All right. So you talk about wireless being a hard-fought battle. Getting the agency to agree that I could launch a journal of classified cybersecurity was a hard-fought battle. It's a won battle. So we've finished now two, and we're starting on the third article, on the third edition. This is important. So journal articles, you might wonder, why does NSA care about journal articles? Archival would be one thing. If it was just a matter of retaining information and passing it on out, there's a lot of ways we could deal with that in a repository. What's important about the journal concept is the peer review and the scrub by peers. It's that notion that you get a lot of eyes who aren't part of our shop, our in-house shop, who have some background, who can take a look at that information and make sure that we haven't omitted something important that others have done, so we're not reinventing the wheel badly. This is part of the way that we can hold ourselves accountable to the scientific community. And as you might imagine, in the classified world, when you're making advances that are largely classified, it's very hard to get those insights. And if you're working with the same team for 10 or 15 years, just think about what that would look like if you only had your internal department colleagues that would ever sign up on your papers. So that was important to put forward. It's also important for those reading the journal to know that there's a place you can look at results that have been scrubbed. So that is an important part of the archival piece. So that's important. We've had two. It's been acknowledged as key to the intelligence community because the director of DNI, the Defense National Intelligence Organization, Clapper, signed the introduction of the second one. So that put the imprimatur that the IC says, this is important, let's make that run. He's my boss's boss's boss, so that's key. He runs the IC. So, and by the way, any of you with clearances, this goes FOUO, also secret on up to TSSCI. Please be welcome to publish in this. Drop me a note. I'll help you get in touch if you need to. Please sign up to be reviewers, and we would love to have editorial boards and people doing special editions on this. So I know some of you have clearances. I just throw that out there. You want to hear the winners? All right. Okay. All right. I think we'll start with the honorable mention. So, honorable mention one. This paper was presented at the 2014 ACM CCS, so this last year. These are, of course, 2014 papers expected to exemplify the best in security of cyber, best of science applied to cybersecurity. And the winner is, or the honorable mention is, Increasing Security Sensitivity with Social Proof, a Large-Scale Experimental Confirmation. And that's written by mainly faculty from CMU and Facebook, Suvik Das, Dr. Adam, Kramer, Laura Dabish, and Professor Jason Hong. So if you could clap for them, appreciate that. I know they're not here. I called them up. I know they're not here. I called and I said, this is Deb, research director from NSA. This is not a crank call. Nobody double-checked my bona fides. I guess one or two knew me, and so that was a giveaway. Second honorable mention, quantitative evaluation of dynamic platform techniques as a defensive mechanism. This is a RAID paper, so as a former member of the program committee a year back, this was a nice one to see. So this is James Jordan, Dr. Hamed Akvari, I never say that quite right, and Dr. Kevin. So you're here today, so you actually could raise your hand if you want to. So congratulations. Another excellent paper. And then the winning paper was IEEE Computer Security Foundation Symposium. And that paper was written by a heavily international group. The first call I made to that team went to Brazil, although we didn't manage to connect. And it is additive and multiplicative notions of leakage and their capacities. And Mario Alvim, Dr. Costas C., I will not even attempt your last name, I apologize. Professor Annabelle McIver, Professor Carol Morgan, and Dr. Katsukya Palmadesa, and Professor Jeffrey Smith. So that was our winner for the year. And we'll be bringing them out to the agency and having them walk through and perhaps have a tour of the unclassified pieces of what we do. So thank you for that indulgence. Thank you. And thank you for those who nominated. What we do with this competition is we don't go out and look for the papers ourselves. We ask people to identify what you think are the best papers in cyber, the best exemplars, and send them to us. We had something like 50 nominations this year. The team brought it down to something like 9 that went in front of a panel of distinguished judges. They brought it down to a top 3 and then gave the others forward as well. I took a look at that and made the final cut, so I did make the final choice, but I hardly endorsed what they agreed with, so we were in violent agreement. Those were the 3 best. So please do submit for the next one. I think the deadline is the first week of December. All right. So we spent enough time on that. I promised questions. We did want to mention it's an international collaboration, by the way. People sometimes think we only work with U.S. citizens. Not true. We do a lot of funding of universities via especially the Science and Cybersecurity Activity through the lablets. There are sub-lablets all over the world that we work with. We also, now, the issue of data has come up several times in terms of perspectives. Folks, I usually can't give you data because my live data is very sensitive. And you don't want my 10-year-old data. So, but there are ways that we've managed to get data out beyond giving people clearances and having them come work with us inside our walls and at Laboratory for Analytic Sciences. And one is by building very large, well-represented data sets. So the VAST challenge every year has recently included insider threat, things of that type, and that's a large body of data that you're very welcome to use. We support this because it's a way for us to get data out that's very similar to the kinds of problems we care about, which lets people come up with visualizations and other techniques that might be helpful for us in the future, and this is a picture of one of those. So I wanted to share that as well. Wanted to put this forward. Cyber resilience is becoming a very important investment area for us in our trusted systems group. We made a tough choice. A lot of the world is diving in on the detection side. and the analytics side for cyber. And the problem with that approach long term is that it's a losing game. It's a whack-a-mole game. If what you're going to do is detect and fix and detect and fix and detect and fix, you can automate it. There's a lot of things you can do, but that's a whack-a-mole game. Long term, that's not a win, because that's a rising tide. And in fact, the better you get at whacking the mole, the better the adversary will often be at figuring out how you're doing the whacking. And so you're, in some sense, raising the cost of defending if you do too good a job of raising your defense and you don't add some kind of irregularity to it so that it's not so easy to test the boundary conditions. So it's not exactly like a virus checker. So that's a pet peeve for me, is that we've, unfortunately, in some cases with our products, by regularizing them and standardizing them too much, and raising them too quickly has made it more expensive for us to defend, which is not a good thing to train your attacker to be better. And so what are some of the other techniques that we should invest in? Since the rest of the world is looking hard at what still remains, and I will fully admit you've got to have it, the analytic tool, that's the tool of choice today, very important. We use it at the agency. But since we're supposed to be more forward-leaning, are looking more in terms of our investment at cyber resilience and moving target activities these days. I put these up, again, largely for reference if you want to take a look at some of the approaches that we're using. So we're looking at those ways you could introduce different kinds of variation. Where might you do variation, data representation, application code, execution environment, where you launch the code, all kinds of things. And then trying to identify in which situations and which kinds of variations are they effective. So the right move at the right time can help you a lot. The wrong move at the wrong time can really do you in. So that's part of where the research is going. That's not the only thing that needs to be covered. Thinking back to that picture I gave you of professionalization, a lot of really great work that's going on in moving target research is still very clearly research, which is appropriate for this time. It's actually where most of our work is as well. It's not scalable yet. But at some point, once you field these moving target or moving defenses or resilience defenses, you're going to have to log them just like we log everything else. So you're going to need to understand the forensics of the situation. You're going to need to know who the adversary was. You're going to need to know if somebody made a mistake in terms of the human engagement, what that mistake was. You're going to need to make sure you were compliant with all rules and requirements. You're going to need to know owner of a system if things go wrong. There's a liability aspect. So all of those pieces need to be baked in ultimately. So we're beginning to look at some of those pieces as well, how that might tie in to a moving target defense. This is a lesser area of investment now, but it's something we need to think through. I'm putting this up in terms of the command and control because it does highlight that you can't simply just launch a great defense and expect then to say, okay, DoD, just install this and expect it's going to work smoothly. We aren't really all that smooth at installing Windows 10 yet. So I think that something as novel as moving target is going to take some work, but it's well worth the investment. And I've just explained why we're headed that direction. Tied to this, many of the moving target defenses involve defensive deception, and that's got a lot of really interesting ramifications. This is where you try to turn the tables on the attacker and make them feel fear and uncertainty and doubt by increasing their workload. Increasing cognitive load is very good, cause the adversary to make mistakes. That's obviously more useful if you're looking at a human adversary and not a programmed adversary. So you're looking now more at a nation state coordinated team in terms of your threat model here. But it's important to evaluate it. It sounds like a good idea. We need to understand what it looks like in practice. We need to answer some important questions, such as if the attacker knows you're using this technique, does it still work? Kind of important, because with the sort of adversary I've just described, you'd expect them to know that you were using this technique. And how also might using defensive deception and even moving target affect the adversary's tactics. So I just mentioned the concern about virus and analytics that are too easy to understand. Are there some things that we would inadvertently drive the adversary to do that we don't want them to do if we go with these techniques? So we need to look at that as well. And we're doing certain series of experiments to take a look there. All right, here's my hook slide here. And I have an ask for you, which is not that we avoid the issue. Actually, I have a couple of asks here. You're technologists. All right, so I know that many of you are involved in this issue, and I want you to know that I thank you for that. A couple of you mentioned you were doing privacy research. Some of you are talking about civil liberties. This is key. And whether we're talking about the U.S. or we're thinking internationally, the thing about research, and that's why I'm saying it, is that research is supposed to envision a better future. And arguably, there are people that would like to see a different way of handling intelligence gathering and many things about cyber defense, whether it's technological or the interplay with privacy and civil liberties than we have today. And the only reason that the only way that that will happen, actually, there's two things that need to be gotten right. Well, three. Probably a dozen. But there's two or three I want to highlight. One, the technologies need to be there. That's partly my job. That's why I put this slide up, is that I'm struggling, wrestling right now with where I want to make my investments as the research director and how we can ensure that the kinds of technologies, the analytics, the defenses that we use are sensitive to support of civil liberties and privacy. Now, part of the problem is that if we talked about cybersecurity being squishy as a science, privacy and civil liberties are even squishier as a science. But there again, I keep coming back to the thought that there are certain aspects that can and should be treated scientifically. And so that's likely where I'm going to come down with placing my bets. Coming back to my comment about cooperation, how we would identify good, secure ways to handle cooperation. Do you want me to come up with the best possible way of doing analytics in terms of civil liberty, sensitivity, and privacy, and then give it to you and you trust that? Or would you like to come up with the best of breed that I can use and I adopt it? So that's my second ask. Okay, because I'm going to head down this path as much as I can. I think that as a globe, we're better off when we have more eyes on the problem, that lots of different perspectives look at how one might invest in this area, and it's not cut and dried. Even thinking about, I won't say privacy is simple, but even thinking about need to share and who owns data. And I'll give you a personal story. So I'm a two-time breast cancer survivor. And one of the reasons my second time through that process was easier than the first is that people put their data, not willingly all of them, when we think about, if you've read the book, what was her name? You know who it is. Yes, Henrietta Lacks. So data taken, cells taken from her without permission that have deeply advanced the cancer mission. So her privacy and civil liberties violated across the board. I might be alive because of that, first time or second time. So the choices we have to make as a world, it's not just about intelligence. It's about what are we willing to share and what's the goal. So on the health side, where do we want to draw those bounds? I think that was way over the boundary, and not that I'd like to be dead, but I do think that we can draw the line better than we drew it there. And so this is something we need to think through, and this is something that needs to be a broad debate, and we need to think through. Again, I'm on my soapbox here, but we need to think through not just the IC's need, not just the security, but all these other needs as well. And how can we think that through in this era of big data analytics, and get it a future we can all buy into and figure out what our individual parts to play are? And that, I think, is critical. Okay? Calm me down. So, all right, so getting back to my play, I'm looking at this, my ask, and I'm hoping we have some conversation here or later as to where you think it would be correct for NSA to weigh in this area. I suspect you'll have some words for me about activities that have taken place in the past, and that is entirely fair game. Data, one of the things we put together as we were looking through at this, we decided let's start with PI. I don't really like PI so much as the right place to start because there's so much legislation around it, but it is convenient. So we're thinking about what kinds of frameworks can we look at. I'm not really happy with where we are here, so I'm putting this out as a Deb's not really happy with thing if you want to make some suggestions as to what we might think through and how we think about the privacy risk, meaning the loss of privacy or the cost of privacy or the non-return on investment, however you want to think about the privacy calculus. I'm not happy that we've got that right yet, but it's something we're exploring. So I'd like to make some stronger investments in this area, but I want to get them right. So this is one of the pieces of where we are. Civil liberties is harder because civil liberties is really even more than privacy a moving target, especially if you step back and think through free speech in this country, the U.S., and you look abroad as well, you've got parallels. So what are those things that have changed so much in the last 100 years? We want to be really careful. I said technologists need to weigh in developing the technology and informing decision makers and voting, things like that, being aware. But also, we need to be sensitive as we build technologies. How much of our current thinking about what's right and proper is embedded into the systems that we won't be able to get out if we change our minds or want to adjust our thinking? Because I'm going to bet that some things we think should be allowed from a privacy perspective or civil liberties perspective right now, we're going to change our minds about within the next 5 years, and that there'll also be either to tighten or release. And there's also going to be things we wish we designed in. So how, as technologists, can we set up frameworks that will enforce things that we'd like to see happen and prohibit those things we wouldn't, but not lock ourselves into a culture that becomes static in that regard. Because I like to think that as a globe, we continue to grow in that area and mature, and that that's an area that's worth investment. So that's really important. We don't need a Y2K privacy scrub to go through every 10 years and get the privacy right in terms of the analytics. If there are some better ways we can do, that would be ideal. So that's part of the ask as well. Right. All right, it's 5 o'clock. So I did say I'd mention Internet of Things. Internet of Things. So here's another area we clearly have a care about. I'm wearing a Fitbit. We needed to make sure that we could bring certain Internet of Things in. One of the concerns is the designing in of RFID tags that come in garments, by the way, easily leverageable. So we have a lot of care abouts in terms of interesting Internet of Things, regardless of how they might be used from an information standpoint. I was just at Black Hat openly and saw the, I had a lot of fun. And people were kind. And we saw connected the cars and so on, a lot of work that's being done in this area, so much change. This is an area, again, where privacy, civil liberties come into play. My care about is mainly in the unclassed world right now, and that's one reason I have the lab that's established, and we're looking at bringing students in. But there's clearly a lot of scope here, and many agencies of various ilk are looking hard at the Internet of Things. I think one of the interesting side effects of this is who should help make sure that the maker culture, that wonderful burgeoning ability of us all to be creators that I see, it's just really nice. It's for you, you're used to this now, but there was a lack of that for a number of years, and it's not just because I wasn't in a campus. I think that it had died a bit. And now there's this huge, wonderful maker culture. People can get at the heart of things the way they used to with Homebrew Computer Club, which dates me. But who's going to secure that and make sure the good practices are used here so that when these things scale out that they don't become less of a benefit than they might be? And again, I don't think that should be us. I think that really this is a place where self-policing would be good, and that's a place, again, where most of you would be very effective ambassadors. I mention this practically everywhere I talk because, again, I don't think it should be us. And if it becomes a national security problem at some stage down the road, it would be either a DHS or an NSA or a kind of a thing to monitor. And I do think this is better if we can get the culture to design in so that at that point, at whatever stage, we don't have a problem to deal with. So with that, I did promise half an hour for questions. I do literally have something like 20 more slides that I could show you, but I think you might be more interested, am I right, in asking me things? No? You want me to keep on going? I'm open. You just have never heard anyone from NSA talk this much. You know I'm an introvert. The things I do for my country, all right. So, something important, I didn't launch this, but I have put my finger on the scale in order to keep it alive. I think it's still important, regardless of all the conversation about standards, that NSA continue not to stranglehold standards, but in places where we have significant expertise to make that available to the nation in a way that the nation can find it palatable to use. And so I've been really delighted with the way we've been approaching the Simon and Spec, which is a lightweight crypto for really intended an Internet of Things devices, very lightweight approach. And it's something that we have released into the wild. It's been well studied by academics outside our walls, outside our funding, which I think is equally important, right? Because if we fund them and people are looking at it, that's a little suspect. So 30 plus papers you can all look at. The standards out there, international standard, crypto community is looking at it, a lot of interest from industry, so that to me is the model that I like. You can tell me if I'm right or if I'm wrong, but I'm really happy with the Simon and Spec, and my team is extremely excited about this. They've been delighted to work with the international community and really hoping that this is a place we can make a contribution. And of course, as with any standard, people can make mistakes, and let's just, from my perspective, I'm going to leave it at that. The more eyes you have on any cryptographic standard, the better. Little thing like Heartbleed was sitting out there for a while. Many could have looked at. So this is good. Keep an eye on that. But we think it's solid, and we're pretty happy with it. And it's out there for all of you to look at. We do a lot of funding in other areas that are interesting to us. Geolocation is clearly important because, again, getting back to the ultimate goal, it's not just about protecting the local infrastructure. It's about figuring out where bad things are happening as well. And so geolocation, how can you get at where a device is important. You think about it, if you know that there's a problem somewhere in the DoD with a computer, if you don't know where that computer is, you're in trouble. And if you want to protect cyber mission forces and you don't know where, if they're in proximity to a device or other kinds of information, whether it's relevant, that's a problem too. So geolocation is clearly important to us. Here's some work we're doing. Cyber situational awareness, I'm putting this out there because this is a pet peeve. This is a lovely diagram. I will say that in this field, we just don't see the scaling. So I'm shown the same sorts of diagrams now that I was shown when I was an academic. So again, gray hair here, folks. If we're looking at things that are roughly the same in 2015 as we were in the 90s. When I was an assistant professor, then we need some leaps of faith. I can tell you where I see most of the breakdowns. One is that we tend to see diagrams that appear to be aimed at commander's intent, so a single individual who needs optics over a lot of information in order to make big muscle movements with troops or managing across facilities and the like, and then we see them given to people that are worker B level that are trying to figure out mix and match with what is the current cyber attack of the moment. Those are very different people. So something I think that would dramatically improve this field is if we thought really through what that target audience is and aimed the diagram at the kind of activity and the time frame that's needed. But it really is just a hard problem. I think also there's some resistance in many places to using the tech. HLT, I put this out. I mentioned it earlier, and I wanted to foot stomp it again. We have a lot of investment. This isn't strictly cyber. This is useful in many aspects of the signals intelligence mission, as well as the IA mission. And we do all kinds of work in human language technology. Now, you might think that that's easy because we've got Siri. The difference between Siri and what we do is that in Siri, Siri wants to understand you. Siri loves you. Most of the people that we want to listen to don't love us. So just enough said about that. And often very difficult to recognize the voice. It's the cocktail party writ large. So how do you figure out the three words that are important that are spoken in a large auditorium with everyone talking at once, say at a coffee break here, really difficult. So how do we deal with multiple languages? Clearly, training more linguists is not the only answer. Speech detection. There are some interesting ramifications that I won't get into with gender recognition. Believe it or not, that can be a useful indicator. And many other things as well. So that's an active area that should not be neglected in terms of cyber. Language and culture is important. Large graph visualization is important, not just in terms of cyber situational awareness. I actually see more use of this when we're looking at the analytics side, because you tend to have analysts who are poring over this. It's great for the discovery mission. Some cyber responses involve the discovery mission as well. So again, when you think through these graphs, the use case that lets someone probe may make more sense from a social network aspect if you're looking at adversaries or concerted attacks when you're thinking through large muscle movements, not so much individual automated, but large muscle movements of intelligent adversaries, meaning human beings as opposed to machine learning that might be more predictable, is important. LAS, I wanted to mention this as well in case some of you want to work with them. They do fund more than North Carolina, and so connecting up with that site, I hope that they've got their external door available so you can figure out how you might weigh in if you want. They're looking at analytic tradecraft. This is really important since it needs to evolve to match not just the discovery mission, but what's appropriate for cyber at all the different timeframes that are involved in cyber. We have tied with that sense making. Again, thinking through, if you were trying to figure out everything that was going on in the world from just the signals that you gathered from overseas, you're probably going to need some automated help. So sense making solutions are ways of figuring out from the data what you've seen before, what you've understood before, and how to get to that next generation. So how can we make sense of what's seen in terms of summarizing perhaps what's been observed, predicting what might come next, checking to see if the things you observe in the world match your predictions so that you might be understanding an event and so on. And by the way, making it happen at the speed of whatever operation is in play. So a cyber operation, of course, you're looking at this kind of time frame, the kinds of things that are crowd-based issues overseas, as we saw with Arab Spring. Those are also very rapid, a little bit slower, so you have a little more time than the cyber. But then there are longer-term muscle movements where you might see a nation changing from one posture to another and one needed to detect that, and that might be more amenable to this style. But that's something we're looking at. Sense-making that we're doing, I thought this was kind of cool. This was from the the students at North Carolina, they thought, well, why don't we use an adventure game in order to do sense making? So when I visited there, they showed me this wonderful attack of orcs on one another, and the sense making was to determine which orc was attacking which one and why, and what was going on with the captain floating down the river. So it was really a different briefing than what I usually get. And, but useful because they were using the underpinnings of the conversations, meaning in this case, the commands that were going on underneath the game, but you could imagine envisioning that one next step up. If you could do that from video, that would be extremely useful. If you could be able to get some indicators for your analysts as to what's going on from a visual perspective as opposed to having to read the text, and that might be more privacy sensitive as well. Okay. Behavioral analysis. So with that, I think I really will stop on this slide because I'm becoming hoarse and won't be able to answer your questions if I keep on much longer. Did want to say this email, you're welcome to write to research_partnership@nsa.gov. That belongs to the unit that I have that's my front door. My email is dafrinc@nsa.gov, but I am a dreadful correspondent. Again, as people who know me know, it just tends to get busy in there. So you're probably better off writing to research_partnership@nsa.gov, and those folks will get the message to me if I need to have it. But they may be able to answer your question if you want. They do our patenting, our CRADA agreement, so if there's something your organization wants to do with ours, if it's possible, they're the place to do it. They're where we handle our open sourcing by and large. Not always, but a lot of our open source work comes through here. A new thing we added this year in response to some questions I got and a request I got from Stanford and then follow-up at AFSEA was for, could you give us hard problems that we could give to our students from time to time? And so we've begun this approach of having a hard problems list that we're trying to refresh roughly 2, 3, maybe 4 times a year. We're trying for 2 now, and I'd like to get it to 3. And what I've done is I've asked each group to tell me, if you had super smart PhD students in front of you and you could just give them a problem set, what would it be? And then we capture that, write it up succinctly, not directing it, not promising funding with it, but just if you could ask, if you, for the good of the nation or just for the interest's sake, what would you think would be the most interesting question? And each one was allowed to submit a couple. We've pulled that all together, and just by writing to research_partnership@nsa.gov, they'll give you the most recent one of those. And I plan to continue that practice as long as people continue asking for it. So we've gotten good feedback. The way people captured the problems was subject matter dependent. The mathematicians used equations. I thought it was great. They were asking for some proofs. And then the computer scientists asked for some different things. So that I hope is a nice contribution. It's not intended to push you in a direction, but just to be helpful. And then as well, organizations that want to work with us and come in and show your wares. I know we've got a vendor community here also. We do a regular research days. So if you're interested in bringing and showing off your technology at NSA Research, you do not have to have a clearance. You do not have to have a classified project. You just need to be interesting enough for them to invite you in. So write to that address. Say you're interested in coming to industry days. And they'll ask for more particulars and then set you up. Right, and so with that, I really will stop and answer any questions you've got. All right, I will be back. Thanks. You've been very patient. Now it's your turn.
I'll throw on. Can they come to the mics, or does it matter?
Oh, I think that they're recording this, so.
Okay.
They. none of my they. Only your they.
Yeah, they've already got time technology. They recorded, several hours ago. We're just in playback mode.
It is true the deputy director asked me to consider time travel, but I think it was a joke. I'm hoping so. Okay,
hi.
More seriously.
Yeah, Tim Starks from Politico. Do you ever think in a very, let's just get to, is it possible at all to just one day have a goal of taking cybersecurity off the table entirely? It's not a problem anymore.
Oh.
And it's kind of a weird DARPA-y kind of.
No, I love that. I actually think that would be nice because there's some senses in which you think you could take it off the table. If you, the whole goal of that clean slate approach originally from cyber was, what if we were to design security in from the beginning and got it right so that users didn't have to think quite so much? So we might end up having to, we're still going to have to engage with our devices. We'd still have to have some responsibility for understanding what sort of environment we were in. But it would be great if we didn't have to teach people about passwords any longer, or worry about whether their biometrics are being stolen, or worry about information leakages. So I think we could do better. I don't see us as being closed, but it's a great DARPA-esque approach, and I love the question. So
thanks.
Please, you're welcome. Of course, I'm an optimist, as you might have gathered, but it's a worthy question, and if we don't ask that, then we're only going to get what we aim at. All right, what else?
Anyone?
All right, so I'll ask you questions.
Are you going to make your slides available?
Did we get them approved for that?
We can.
Yeah, we can either, we'll either have them posted, or if they're not, then we're going to make them available through this. Happy to do it. I will ask questions. So what irritates you most about NSA? I didn't say that'd be softball questions. Did you have a different question? You can ask one, or you can answer that one. That's where I'm going. I seriously do need to understand and take back messages. So it doesn't hurt my feelings when you answer that question. And you probably have a tough one.
I just wanted to know, how do you reconciliate NSA cybersecurity mission, where you're supposed to protect people, cyber infrastructure, with your offensive capabilities, where you explicitly may provide a deterministic random number generator, or implicitly by inaction, knowing you actually have insert into routers and other equipment, knowing of vulnerability but not disclosing them?
I think that's an excellent question. So let me phrase it the way I can answer it, because as you know, some aspects of it get me into, I don't want to answer a question to a thing I wasn't there for, but I can get at the heart of your question. And I will also refer you to Dr. Wertheimer's note to the AMS, which is the most the agency is able to release on some of what you're describing. But you notice we've got two missions, IA mission and foreign intelligence, and part of foreign intelligence is getting at the heart of what you described, which is the equities problem. So if our goal is to discover information other people don't want us to have, no matter whether we're getting it by cyber or something else, and if another goal we have is to make sure that the defense, the DoDIN, and the United States by extension, and of course since it's an international market, the world by some lighter extension, is more secure and proof against information stealing, how do we reconcile that? Because you would think that that's impossible. Yet both tasks are needed, because if we don't get the information, we can't address the mission. If we don't protect the secrets, then everything's gone. So how do we do it? It tends to be case by case. It is case by case. We've begun another process that has that is capturing that even further, with a risk balancing, with when do you make a pro and a con. But generally speaking, you look at an action and you'll say, all right, what's my release of Simon and Speck is exactly an example of that. So Simon and Speck intended to help us protect the Internet of Things, those that wish to exploit the Internet of Things, not even saying within our agency, but just clearly an equity. In this case, we successfully made the argument that it's more important to the nation and the globe to release protections that would make the Internet of Things more secure. So believe it or not, but please look at the standard. Don't ever take anyone's word for standard. Anyone's. So that decision was made. In general, our direction now from Admiral Rogers is, if there's a tie, the win goes to IA. Will we get it right every time? I don't know. But if in our view there's a tie, the win should go here. If there's more value the other way, then the foreign intelligence mission can win.
How do you quantify that?
This is not my job. It usually comes down to starting to add the value, and the loss of life, you can look at danger to the nation, the same way we identify whether something is a TSSCI. If it's not grave harm, we have ways of looking at whether we think that would be grave harm, but we need more classification. We apply some of that when we take a look
at. But we have unintended consequences in long-term harm versus short-term expediency, and so these things are really hard to balance off against each other.
They are excruciating. Some of the most difficult conversations we can. Research director rarely has to do this. I'd actually argue there's some research equity, which is why I've become a little more part of the process, that we have a duty for the good of the nation to release things like sign-in inspection. That's kind of a proactive, let's fix a thing before it becomes a problem, which is different than let's patch a thing that's already a problem. So that's my piece. And I really don't want to put words in the mouth of those that are making the other conversation. If you want, I'll ask them to write down a little more succinctly than what I'm about to say. I'll be able to respond to your question if you wish. But what I would say to you is that I see thoughtful conversation. I see looking at the short term and the long term. And I see people that are humans and get it right most of the time. And I bet that each one of them on my decision table should be another one. But if there was some benefit done by the choices of them, it's hard. But choosing not to make the decision is also a decision. Choosing not to leverage, and I'm not talking about where I know you're going. I'm sorry, no, I'm guessing wrong. I'm thinking you're talking standards, but I literally can't go there. But
it's hard to measure.
It's really hard to measure, and it's painful. And it's the kind of thing that people talk about years later about decisions. So when I came in, I asked for a lot of stories from my peers. What is it that was hard for you when you joined the agency? What are some of the most difficult choices? And those equities ones were way up there. When you get passion on the IA side, we must do this for the good of the nation. You get passion on the foreign intelligence side, we've got to know this or people will die, whether it's near term or long term. And so while there are risk matrices that are looked at, there's thoughtful conversations, there's also a human spirit in a way. I don't think you can stand on your own. And I think people should think hard about tough choices like that. And I think if they wish they could make a different choice, that they should feel regret. But I don't think, and that's one reason I'm staying where I'm staying, I don't think we can take, some of us need to stay on with it. Hopefully we can make that tough choice and stand in a room like this. I used to be able to come as a researcher and just say, oh, this is how I measure it, and say, sometimes I'm going to go wrong. And it's so fast. So help us with that.
So my example is from way before your time, but in William Friedman's biography, they mentioned that, or they claimed that the NSA sabotaged this communication security of NATO, making it vulnerable to Soviet communication after Suez, because the United States started to mistrust NATO allies. And so I wonder, to what degree should we import notions of command responsibility into research, such that if an agency such as the NSA participates in something which greatly reduces the United States national security, which if you believe the biography, it did, that they're held accountable? Or should research be sort of treated as not the policymakers and they just, make things happen?
Yeah, well, I'd love to take myself entirely off the hook. So I can't answer the prep to your question.
Sure,
you
sure.
know I've got that, so fine that you said it. Got it. Command responsibility. So we are led by a four-star. There's a four-star general. Now is a four-star general. He has command responsibility for the entire agency. And so should we make a major mistake, then that man's next on hook. Comes down to SLT, so I don't know if I said it explicitly, but I am part of the senior leadership team for the agency. I report to the deputy director, who reports to the director. So I sit, for now, we reorg like that all the time. So right now I sit with the signals intelligence director and the IA director and the NTOC director and the deputy director for CyberCom, and we meet as a team, and so I am part of that conversation. So the research director is part of those that inform the leadership, and also certain things fall into my back pocket. So where I would be most likely to be held accountable, it's a little harder because you can't tell if I've done a great job really for 10 years with some of the decisions, although some of the near-term ones, yes. I have day-to-day responsibility for decisions like sign and inspect. So if I decide to release something to the code base that harms the United States, I can and should be held accountable. It should not be my people. I sign off on those things.
We also use real data, live data, and I instituted a policy that says I have a conversation with every lead who's going to use that live data so that I sign off on it personally, so that any time if there should be a misuse of that data, if it's got you as person's data in it and you've missed it, it's my neck, not my people's. So that's my role. So yes, I have that responsibility for the decisions, I have responsibility for handling the data, and I will not let my people take the fall from it. So there you go.
If you're given a policy directive, though, do you have a responsibility not to follow that policy decision?
Oh, you're getting into that. That's a philosophical thing.
I don't think NSA pitched this on the president. I think I don't know how it happened, and it is just a claim, but I believe it like
came
from the top.
I so far haven't quit a job over, I think that you are doing something really stupid and you're not listening to me.
I haven't said quite as bluntly to any person in my chain of command here or elsewhere, I think you're really stupid and you're not listening to me. I have said, I think that there is something very wrong with this decision, and I really strongly urge we do not make that choice. In many places I've worked, I don't expect to stop. So that would again be the responsibility of anyone at the agency. And of course, if we see something going badly wrong, we all have the responsibility to become part of the federal whistleblower conversation. We do not have a responsibility, in my mind, to release the information generally, but we do have a responsibility and a fairly easy process that we take mandatory training in every year, due by December, that explains to us in detail how to do that and what the protections are. And also, as a manager, I'm required to take training that tells me how to protect those in my organization that might go that kind of a route, and what the culpability I have, which are civil as well as other responsibilities for making sure that they're protected. So there's those, if you're wondering about are there ways for people in my position to get word out, there are. Nobody knows till they're put to the question though how far they'll go. So I won't promise to throw myself on the sword, you'll just have to take it from what you know of me, whether I would or wouldn't.
Thank you.
Probably all my voice will handle food. You've been very patient. What do you want as your last one? Unless you like my last one. All right, good. Thank you.
I'm Steve Bellahan from Columbia University, and I do not mean this as an attack, but how? No. It will be.
I appreciate that because I asked for tough questions.
Yes, that might sound hurtful. In light of the, I'll call them allegations about things like dual EC, in light of allegations going back to the 56-bit key length in DES, in light of comments earlier about other games played, how can the NSA establish trust with anything they release, even Simon and Speck, for example? And yes, you know, the open community can look at Simon and Speck and analyze it, and if you guys don't know more about crypto design than the open community, you're not doing your jobs.
We are doing our jobs.
So you're making a really good point. Sorry, that slipped out. I'm really proud of our folks. They're very good. So yes, and that's something the community has to answer. So from my part, I can go only so far. I can come to an event like this and put myself on the line and let you see depth, as well as much of the agency as I want to share. So you can get a sense of at least the ones of us that you meet, which you haven't gotten to meet before. Do you think that we would do a good job or not? I can push to have code made open and push for publication, and I can push for people to cross our lines and maintain and support of places like LAS. What I cannot and would not do is buy trust. So that's something that has to be earned, and it's something that you'll give when you expect that we should be trusted. I meant when I said no one should ever be trusted with any standard, because you can make a mistake. And you can have a really smart insider who will inject something in code that you're sharing too, as we all know. So I think that the community has to get very good at spotting those that would do us harm. And it's the NSA is, say what you like, we aren't successful unless this country is free. That's our reason. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that good people come who care about the civil liberties and the safety, who are willing to make the hard choices, that's partly how the community will do it. That's not unilateral. And I don't know if the community will trust us again. I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
I can only do so far.
All right, so we'll stop there. Thank you very much, you've been great.